I'm Neil Love from Research to Practice, and welcome to Management of Locally Advanced Non-Small Cell Lung Cancer, a virtual meeting held in conjunction with the ONS Bridge Symposium, Virtual Symposium. We're thrilled to have our faculty of Kelly Goodwin, David Spiegel, Heather Wakely, and Liz Waxman joining us here today to discuss this. We have two modules. We have a very specific focus that's going to really allow us to get into the granularity. You know that our approach to oncology education for nurses has a little bit of a different flair for it. We get into the idea of oncology strategy. What's the rationale for how the patient is being treated, particularly with respect to new therapies such as the one we're talking about today, and then how to help get the patient through on teaching them as they go along. So we're going to start out. We're going to talk about some of the benefits that can be seen in this situation and how to explain that to a patient. And then some of the tolerability issues that come up and how to get patients through that. But just so kind of to take a breath before we get started, I want to start out with David and ask you to maybe talk a little bit about a typical scenario that you might see a patient like this in. Often we're talking about people who've just been diagnosed with the disease, and they're just, their whole life is changing in terms of how, you know, the next year or so in terms of therapy. Can you talk a little bit, David, about your experience with patients in this situation, the concerns that come up, and some of the initial things that you talk to them about?
Yeah, sure, Neil. Thanks for having me. I think one of the most difficult parts is the beginning of just recognizing that you're dealing with an aggressive cancer. You know, stage three cancer, I emphasize, is curable. But for those individuals that want to get a little more detailed information about what are we talking in terms of chance of survival, you know, the statistics are not good. Saw a young man today, and we're still trying to sort out stage three or stage four, and it's a difference between a chance for cure and not. Most you know, often that's the dividing line. And so that for me is often the toughest part of that initial conversation is we're dealing with a very aggressive cancer, chance of cure, but it's going to take some effort. It's going to require chemotherapy, radiation, a year of something called immunotherapy. It can be a complicated conversation. And a lot of times I notice my patients and their families are still stuck on the small chance of being cured. And I think that's the difficult thing.
And that's completely understandable. Liz, I'm curious about your experiences in this situation. You know, such a change in life. You know, of course, we've all kind of gone through a change in life, I think, in general over the last 6 months. And this is another one that comes in. Can you talk a little bit, Liz, about some of your thoughts? One of the things I've heard people say, you know, as David was talking about, a lot of these patients are going to die in spite of this tremendous investment. I've heard people say that chemo radiation therapy, your locally advanced disease, is one of the most difficult therapies we have in oncology to get people through. Liz, what's your experience at the beginning of this, trying to get people to understand what's going to be involved?
Well, I try to explain to patients that we're being very aggressive in treating their cancer, and we're trying to do the best for them to achieve hopefully a durable response and give them a good quality of life. But I do explain that there are going to be side effects and toxicities, including fatigue, difficulty swallowing, odynephagia and dysphagia, and I don't use those terms with patients. And that we do have weekly clinic visits. We have every 3 week clinic visits for toxicity checks. And we keep a fairly focused eye on these patients. And if they're having difficulty in between their clinic visits or during their treatment, we'll bring them into clinic and assess them. We'll support them with what's needed, including IV hydration a few times a week. We have them meet with a nutritionist up front to help them with dietary changes that they may need during treatment. And I try to emphasize to the patients that we're going to see them through this from beginning to end of treatment, and then afterwards, that they're not alone through this treatment regimen.
So, Kelly, you know, another issue that comes up in lung cancer patients in general, including this situation, is some of these patients are currently smoking. Many of them have previously smoked. And I'm curious how sort of the feelings about smoking enter into this dynamic when they're first diagnosed.
Right. I think we're lucky at Mass General to have a smoking cessation group. So if patients are still smoking, we typically refer them to that group for either help with nicotine replacement patches or gums, things like that, or kind of cognitive behavioral therapy to help support them through that. We don't try and scare them in that continuing to smoke will make their cancer progress, but that certainly continuing to smoke will lead to complications during treatment, which might delay therapy or might impede our ability to keep the therapy on course with the most aggressive dosing and schedule if they were to develop pneumonias or flares of their underlying lung disease like COPD or something like that. So we certainly do try and support them. And with the focus on this being aggressive, potentially curable therapy, we want to make sure that they are healthy going forward and that we're always minimizing the chance for a secondary cancer or something like that. And I think that we give that same kind of education to their family as well. Unfortunately, with COVID, we're not really allowed to see family members in the clinic very often. But I do talk to family members after doing like a formal chemotherapy teach with patients. And I try and reinforce the importance of minimizing smoking around the patient if another family member in the home is smoking, also encourage them to quit smoking and refer them to our smoking cessation group to better support the patient and to help them certainly with, with anxiety or other triggers that might lead them to relapse. The cancer diagnosis is very anxiety provoking and they're often smoking because they're anxious or to take their mind off things. And so it's very important to be able to support them psychologically and emotionally through this.
So, Heather, you know, MGH, where Kelly is, really, they were leaders in terms of the issue of palliative care in lung cancer, and that model now has been embraced by many different subspecialties. I'm curious some of the sort of existential issues and psychosocial issues that come up, Heather, in this situation, newly diagnosed lung cancer in general, and this situation specifically.
So that's a great question because it's really, we can talk about the specifics of the treatments, but it's really the treatment of the whole patient and their family that's so critical to help them get through this time. So we try to address that head on. And David talked about when he's talking with the patient, he's trying to emphasize that we are trying to cure people. But as Liz had emphasized, you know, we don't want to shy from the fact that it's going to be tough and it's going to need a support team to help them get through it. And so doing whatever we can to help them from a nutrition standpoint, from other health perspectives, and that's sort of where the smoking cessation comes in, but also acknowledging that they're going to be anxious, that this is a really hard time to be getting through. And I try to talk with them also about the fact that, you know, the first 6-7 weeks are the most intense when they're going through the chemo radiation. But for a lot of patients, the time after that is actually harder. And even with immune therapy now, we sort of push that off until they're through with that. But when they finish the treatment, that is even harder because they no longer feel like they're actively fighting against the cancer. And yet they know that there's a high risk of it coming back. So I try to bring that in really early so that we're talking about it and there's an awareness of that. And so if someone is seeming to, and I ask people about this too, because you can't always tell just by, sometimes you can tell when someone's having a particularly hard time, but you can't always. And so try to bring it out into the open and talk about the services that we have. We have some psychologists that work specifically with our cancer patients and are very open. We have some fabulous social workers as well who can help with some of the support networks that people might need. But just making sure that everyone knows it's okay to talk about any of the fears and anxieties that they're going through, because if those don't get addressed, it certainly have an impact on their general wellness. And then for some of the other symptom management, the palliative care, so supportive team can be really helpful too. Some of the, esophagitis issues or pain issues, if those become a stronger issue for a particular patient. So we talk about that.
So we have a pretty extensive slide set, but really we're here today to make rounds to talk. So we're not going to focus a lot on the slides. We'll sort of click through them, but what we really want to do is talk. And David, let's begin by talking about what locally advanced non-small cell lung cancer is, and in particular, how we stage patients to make the determination that no, they're not surgically resectable. No, they don't have metastatic disease. They fall in the middle here.
Yeah, I mean, it's been a little bit of a shifting target, but the core kind of dividing line has been the presence of mediastinal disease. So really N2 disease makes you a stage 3 cancer. You could not have nodal disease and have a large tumor. That's another way to do it, what we call a T4 N0 stage 3. But by and large, N2 disease, so usually that's discovered through a biopsy. You hope through navigational bronchoscopy, a biopsy of a carinal node or a paratracheal node. Different stations get assessed. It can be done other ways through mediastinoscopy. And then, of course, the absence of metastatic disease. So it's important to complete your staging with PET scanning. I mentioned this young man I saw today. So an adrenal abnormality, a questionable brain lesion. Got to work those up. That probably is stage 4 cancer. So, you know, most of your patients, if you go looking, you'll find things, but you need to be sure you're dealing with stage 3 disease. And then, as you mentioned, is this patient a surgical candidate or not? That can be somewhat controversial, but the reason for a multidisciplinary tumor conference to assess patients like that, and for a lot of places, that dividing line comes down to the extent of mediastinal disease, what we call multi-station disease. So if there's limited mediastinal involvement, that patient is potentially a surgical candidate. If there's multiple stations or bulky disease, that patient is usually not. One fascinating thing, and then I'll finish, is I think with the success of immunotherapy, and Heather, I'd be curious about your thoughts here, whether we're seeing patients that were marginally candidates for surgery in the past actually not go to surgery because, you know, we think chemo, radiation, immunotherapy is the way to go.
So let's talk a little bit about the strategy involved, you know, again, to try to help explain to the patient. And Kelly, you know, one of the issues here is the fact that, you know, what we're talking about is that for many years, patients have gotten chemotherapy and radiation therapy. Now we're talking about adding in immunotherapy after that. And you can see there's a whole bunch of trials that have looked at different strategies prior to using immunotherapy that were not very effective or weren't really effective. But then we're going to talk about immunotherapy. Can you talk a little bit about these patients are going to get chemo radiation, and at that point, the question is going to come up about using so-called consolidation durvalumab. What kind of condition are these people usually in at that point? They've had chemo radiation. A lot of them are already starting to get symptoms from that. What are some of the typical syndromes that you see?
Yeah, I think it is a little bit dependent on what they get for their chemotherapy when they're getting concurrent radiation therapy. For really robust patients, depending on their histology, you know, we may be using a combination of cisplatin and pemetrexed with radiation, which is really quite toxic, highly emetogenic, lots of fatigue. For a patient who might be a little bit older and have other comorbidities, is maybe not so robust, we may be using something like weekly carboplatin and paclitaxel with radiation, and they tend to tolerate that a little bit better. You know, I would say that most people on weekly carbo paclitaxel are doing quite well through week 3 or 4 of concurrent therapy, and then maybe start complaining of kind of cumulative fatigue or appetite changes. Maybe at that point, some esophagitis and maybe requiring some either topical analgesics or even some PO analgesics or support with some IV chemotherapy. And then I think we do try and set the expectation that even if you tolerate concurrent chemotherapy and radiation therapy quite well, the radiation is still sort of doing its thing for a couple weeks after therapy ends. And it may be that you are feeling at your worst the first 1, 2, 3 weeks after radiation ends. Just like Liz said, we continue to see these patients weekly during concurrent therapy. Even if they're getting, you know, 2-3 weeks cisplatin and pemetrexed, we still see them weekly to make sure we're staying on top of symptom management and that they're holding their own. And really by weeks 3-4, you're deciding kind of when you might be starting the consolidative durvalumab. You want to make sure that performance status is okay. They're still up and about. They can kind of make the trek into the hospital every other week still, that their counts have recovered, that their oral intake is adequate. And so I would say as we approach week 3 and 4, we start to talk about what the coming weeks will look like and when it's likely we would get some new scans just to establish that that their cancer remains localized, and then start the durvalumab. We try and give them a couple weeks, I would say, to either recover from the toxicities of concurrent chemotherapy and radiation, or really just to catch their breath after being with us Monday through Friday for radiation for 6 weeks or so. They need a little bit of time. So we try and give them a couple weeks for that, but certainly not longer than, say, 6 weeks or so, which is what the study had recommended.
So, again, this is a real challenge for a patient to get through, and yet the hope that you'll see is that their cure rate is actually going to, after all these negative trials, that actually the chance of, well, let's just say of survival, we'll see whether it's cure. Heather, can you talk a little bit about sort of the mechanism of what the thinking is? There is a so-called abscopal effect, the idea that something like radiation therapy could put antigens into the circulation that the immune system can respond to. Can you talk about that and how that actually led into the Pacific trial to really look at this?
Certainly. When I try to explain this to patients, I talk about the fact that a cancer cell is very much like most cells in our body, except for a few small things, right? And it's those few small things that make it the cancer. And what we're trying to do is help the immune system recognize those differences so that it can properly attack the cancer without starting to attack normal parts of the tissue of the body and therefore setting off the autoimmune toxicities that we worry about with these drugs. And so the concept is that at a time when the cancer cells are dying, being broken apart in some way, that's a time when these antigens, the neoantigens, the proteins that make the cancer cells different than normal, are more likely to be accessible to the immune system, more likely to be out there where they can be identified. And so that's the idea behind giving chemotherapy or radiation and setting off a response. Now, with the abscopal effect with radiation, we talk about it only with the localized therapy because the same thing could be happening with systemic therapy, but you wouldn't be able to tell the difference. But the idea with the abscopal is that if you are giving radiation to cancer in one area, and at the same time you're giving immune therapy, because of the radiation, theoretically, there are more neoantigens being exposed. There's going to be a better immune response. And then those immune cells are then going to track out through the rest of the body and find other areas where there might be cancer so that the localized therapy is going to set off a better immune response elsewhere. Obviously, if you're giving systemic treatment, you wouldn't be able to see that that was happening. And so that's why we kind of talk about it more with radiation. And so the idea behind Pacific, and I think really behind doing radiation plus immune therapy together, is that concept that if there's some way that we can expose the different parts of the cancer cell better, you're going to get that better immune response. And there were also some safety concerns, because maybe you're going to get too robust of a reaction, because if you're doing radiation, you're breaking apart cancer cells, but there might be some damage normal tissue also, especially in the lungs. And so there was a lot of fear that we could be setting off more autoimmunity at the same time that we were leading to a better anti-cancer response. So this was approached with caution. But as most of the audience already knows, and we'll talk about now, we didn't need to be too cautious. This ended up working out very, very well.
Yeah, absolutely. And Liz, I guess, like a lot of situations in oncology, really you have patients following the same path that was created by the clinical trial. You're trying to reproduce what happened in a clinical trial. Here we're talking about the Pacific study. We'll talk about the details of that in a second. But previously, patients would get chemo radiation and then they would just start the process of healing. They'd be all therapy. Now they're committing for a prolonged treatment for a year. How do you sort of prepare people for the year, Liz, in terms of the year of immunotherapy?
Well, we tell patients that we're going to continue treating after the chemotherapy and the radiation therapy, in effect, to consolidate, for lack of a better word, the treatment's effect from the concurrent treatment, and also to help the body recognize any potential circulating cancer cells that we just don't yet see, so that hopefully we can stave off a recurrence and give them a better quality of life. I do tell patients it's going to be a long duration of treatment, every 2 weeks for a year. But the treatment is tolerable. There are different side effects than the chemotherapy, definitely. And I try to counsel patients that it's going to be a long haul, but hopefully in the end they'll have a longer time of disease-free survival and overall survival improvement.
So let's talk about the trial that really changed our approach here, David, the Pacific study. Can you talk about what exactly was done in the trial? This is a randomized placebo trial, which is pretty interesting to try to do a trial like that. What did they look at and what did they find?
Yeah, so this study was really looking at what do you do with immunotherapy after standard therapy. So patients were randomized after they completed chemo radiation. It's an important point because that meant that participants could receive chemo radiation as according to their institutional standards or the preference of the physician and team there and the patient, of course. And then the randomization was really durvalumab for a year. It's every other week, or a placebo, and that's important. Patients had to be randomized to a placebo, which can make a study like that seem difficult. PFS, OS were the primary endpoints, and here's what we know. We know that PFS was improved for the group that received durvalumab for a year after chemo-RT, and then we know that survival was improved as well.
And just, you know, we've been talking about, you know, these kinds of trials comparing two therapies, and the key number being the HR, the hazard rate that you see up there. And for progression, in other words, recurrence, it's 0.5, which means it's cut in half. And then survival, not quite as much, but still very substantial by more than 30%. So this is a really tangible, important outcome. Some of the issues have been like, when do you give the therapy? We're going to get into some of the specifics in terms of when you give therapy. Also, another issue that's come up is PD-L1 status and as well as mutation status. And Kelly, maybe you can comment a little bit about that. In general, the trial just looked at everybody together. They did these further analyses. Any thoughts about that, as well as looking at for mutations such as EGFR?
Sure. I understand that the study didn't randomize patients based on their PD-L1 status. We are lucky in that our pathology department gives us PD-L1 staining with every biopsy. It's not only with metastatic patients, but we get that information early. And we, you know, in an appropriate patient who doesn't have, you know, severe underlying autoimmune disease and tolerates the therapy well, we go on and push through with consolidative durvalumab, regardless of PD-L1 percentage. But it is helpful information given the high risk of recurrence. To already have that information on hand if a patient does develop metastatic disease during their year of consolidative therapy, to inform the next steps, the first-line therapy for metastatic disease. It's also helpful for us at a large academic institution for clinical trial eligibility. The same for the mutation status, EGFR or ALK. Sometimes we have early stage trials available for patients with a targetable mutation, or it can help us to decide metastatic treatment if a patient recurs during their therapy. So it's information that we always have, but I would say it doesn't necessarily impact the choice of our chemotherapy backbone when we're giving concurrent chemotherapy radiation, nor does it affect durvalumab, the PD-L1 stain that is. It's certainly mutation status would certainly affect what we use as consolidative therapy after aggressive chemotherapy radiation.
So we want to go through a bunch of questions that the faculty, you four, as well as the four for the other program that we're going to do, have put out to us. And see how you respond. In some cases, we're going to show all your responses. But just kind of starting out, Liz, if a patient were to ask you, do most people who get chemo radiation therapy nowadays get durvalumab? Is it really considered in general a standard? How do you respond to that?
I would say yes. I don't know if it's considered standard, but it is what the practices are doing now, or at least it, in my institution, following concurrent treatment.
So, you know, another issue is whether or not the patient needs any kind of workup before starting therapy. And Heather, we know that the trial actually had an imaging study done. A lot of people question whether it's necessary, including you, as I see here. Mm-hmm. Even the I hear that a lot of insurance companies want to see a negative CAT scan. Any comments about, you know, this is kind of a residual from the trial itself and why you decide not to do this?
So the reason I say no is that we don't tend to in practical terms at our institution. Part of that is because we believe in the subset analysis showing that patients who are able to start durvalumab in a pretty tight time window after ending the chemo radiation seem to have better outcomes. There's a lot of debate about whether that's a true biological phenomena related to those new antigens still being out in circulation, or whether it's just that the patients who were in better shape were able to start sooner and therefore did better, right? So that's an ongoing controversy, but our team seems to, you know, tends to believe that. So we want to get people moving quickly on that therapy. As part of the radiation course, most patients have had some imaging partway through to help with sort of the final aspects of that radiation. And so you have a sense. And if somebody's going to be a true not responder, which is a pretty small subset, they've already been identified. So the likelihood that we're going to identify other of those folks is pretty low, which is why we don't do it again. And then there's some older data from before the era of durvalumab, where if you look at outcomes of people who had gone through chemo radiation, there were definitely patients who had absolutely zero radiographic response, who had had really tremendous biological response. So we just didn't think it's that relevant. And so that's why we don't emphasize it. And I've never had an issue with getting durvalumab coverage by insurance without having had that CT, but I acknowledge fully that it can be different in different parts of the country.
So, of course, one of the tricky things about this situation is you have two competing sources of morbidity. One, theoretically, anyhow, one would be the chemo radiation, and the other would be the durvalumab. And Liz, can you talk a little bit about sort of the time course? Before we started to see durvalumab, then all you were seeing was the chemo radiation. The time course of what happens, the two big problems, of course, I think you mentioned before, gastritis or effects on the bowel, as well as pneumonitis. What's the typical time sequence just from the chemo radiation that you see this?
I think it's, as Kelly said earlier, probably midway through the concurrent treatment, we start seeing the beginnings of the toxicities of treatment around week three or four. Our patients are starting to complain of some pain with swallowing or food getting stuck. They're fatigued. So it's really midway towards the end of treatment where the toxicities really seem to come into play and kick in. It's also in that time frame where by their counts, they may be too low for chemotherapy, so we'll hold a week of chemo but still do the radiation. And so by the time they finish concurrent treatment, they do need a break, and we give them a break. We are getting them through the toxicities again with hydration, nutrition. Once in a blue moon, we've had to do a enteral nutrition, but that's very rare. But my patients who have needed enteral nutrition, thankfully there are a few of them, actually started recovering better because they had a source of protein to help with the healing from the esophagitis.
So, David, you know, the idea of, you know, you look at the numbers from the trial and patients want that kind of benefit. And the question I want to ask you, and we actually asked the entire faculty, is are there any contraindications, relative or complete contraindications to starting therapy? And one theme, and I see you put down here, severe autoimmune histories or severe pneumonitis from radiation. Can you talk a little bit about those kinds of clinical scenarios and what you do?
Yeah, I think it's you know, I like Kelly's comment about a relative consideration of autoimmune illness, because somebody with psoriasis or very mild, you know, inflammatory bowel disease is somebody that probably is a candidate for immune-based therapy. However, somebody that's on active therapy or intense therapy for symptomatic autoimmune history, that's a bigger concern. So I'll give you an example. I have a woman right now with rheumatoid arthritis. Most folks I see with rheumatoid arthritis, to me, either don't have it or it's very mild. You know, they're misdiagnosed or it's been very mild. This patient is on 2-3 month rituximab. That's something that's pretty severe. She's miserable when it flares. In my mind, she's not a candidate for immunotherapy. Not only is it risky just in terms of toxicity, but her quality of life is going to go down. So it's relative. You have to understand what the condition is, how they've been dealing with it before, how are they managing it now, how bad has it gotten. I'd notice some of our colleagues, Govindan, put some absolute things there, like organ transplant. I would agree with him. That would make me nervous. He put lupus. I tend to agree, but we know there are various degrees of that. So I'm not sure there's a one size fit all answer, except for maybe something like organ transplant.
Yeah. So another issue I wanted to bring up was actually brought up by David, but I want to see what Heather has to say about it. And that is, are there any situations where you do this sequentially? You don't give the chemotherapy and the radiation together, but you do it. You do it sequentially. You do one first and then the other. There are a bunch of other variations to what was done in the Pacific trial that we hear questions about. Patients who, for example, only get radiation without chemotherapy. How do you approach these sort of unusual situations, Heather?
That's a great question. And really, I mean, we have data from a couple decades ago that if you can give concurrent chemotherapy radiation, the outcomes are better than sequential chemotherapy and then radiation or vice versa. So we always try to do concurrent whenever we can. But there are going to be cases of patients who are too frail, where you really are worried that they're not going to be able to handle them together. In which case, the radiation is, in my mind, the more definitive curative thing. The chemo is enhancing that radiation impact and dealing with those circulating tumor cells that Liz had brought up. Any sort of escaper cells is what I'll often talk about. So if you can only pick one, it's the radiation. If you can't give concurrent, then you have to really weigh, well, why is this patient going to be able to tolerate that sequential chemo when they couldn't get it concurrent? Because as Kelly brought up, weekly carboplatin paclitaxel with radiation is usually pretty well tolerated. So, you know, I consider that kind of chemo light, and I'll do concurrent chemo light if someone's a bit more frail. I have had a couple of cases. Remember, I'm in Northern California, of the absolute chemo refusers. Okay, like I do everything. I can be pretty persuasive, except with my 17-year-old daughter. You know, so I'm like doing everything I can to convince them that chemo is really what they need to add to their radiation. Few will absolutely under no circumstances do that. And then I'm willing to give them immune therapy afterwards, though sometimes that's a little tricky to get covered because the indication is only after concurrent chemo plus radiation. So you don't know if you can get it. So those are my sort of unusual examples, but I do everything I can to try to convince people to get the combined chemotherapy radiation, emphasizing, as we've heard from the other panelists, we don't have a great chance of cure, but we have a chance for cure. So we want to do everything we possibly know to do to give that patient that opportunity to be cured.
Heather, just a follow-up question. We were talking before about the fact that the trial used Q2 weeks durvalumab. Mm-hmm. And of course, there's a real movement towards stretching out therapies. We have Q6 weeks pembro now in metastatic disease. Mm-hmm. Q4 week durvalumab has been used in other trials. Do you use that or you stick with the Q2?
So I will start with Q2 for the first month or so, just to make sure I'm not going to have someone who's going to have a really severe immune reaction right away. And then I'll try to switch them to Q4, and I've been able to for some of my patients, but for others, I've had insurance absolutely refuse to do it. So they stay on every two.
So we want to go on now and talk a little bit about the tolerability issues that come up. We're going to go through a bunch of specific scenarios, but just sort of getting back to the trial, David, as we were talking about before the results came up, everybody was all nervous about whether or not we're going to see more pneumonitis. Can you talk about what was actually seen in the Pacific trial, particularly as it relates to pneumonitis?
Yeah, Neil, you really hit on it. I think everybody was very nervous, and you know, an ongoing Pacific study looking at Durva with chemo RT. There, you know, this is one of the main concerns about it. And so, what you see is a couple of things. One is pneumonitis is common. It's not new to the field of stage three treatment. I mean, it's something we've seen before with radiation. And what's shown here is most patients get some form of it. Nearly everybody does. In terms of severe pneumonitis, I think what surprised everyone when this was initially presented is that second row there, that it's not that much more severe pneumonitis with immunotherapy. And then, of course, you want to know, did that lead to death or increase major morbidity? And the answer is no, that it's serious. You need to recognize that, but it can happen even in the placebo arm.
Right. And I want to talk a little bit about sort of how this actually plays out in practice in terms of, you know, what patients actually experience as it relates to immune toxicity. We were talking about transplant, we're talking about autoimmune disease. And of course, the issue is that we're stimulating the immune system here. And in some cases, that can cause immune effects, particularly as it relates to prior autoimmune disease. Kelly, can you talk a little bit about sort of some of the basic things that you go through? And of course, this applies to many other areas in lung cancer and outside of lung cancer in terms of immune-related toxicity from checkpoint inhibitors.
So initially, when patients are undergoing concurrent chemotherapy and radiation, they have an hour-long chemotherapy teach session with an APP. And then as we approach the end of concurrent therapy and we're going to start talking about durvalumab, they actually come in for another kind of dedicated teaching session where we discuss how immunotherapy works and some of the potential side effects and how they differ from chemotherapy and radiation. It's kind of a fun opportunity to teach patients about what we do every day because chemotherapy works one way, right? It's not very smart. It's not targeted directly at your cancer. It's hitting any cells that are actively dividing and still growing. You know, by definition, cancer, abnormal growth of cells. Radiation is smart, and our physicists are very smart at targeting their tumors, but there's always a little bit of scatter to some of the good tissue, and that's where your side effects come from. And then immunotherapy works much different. It's much smarter and is harnessing the power of your own body, your own immune system. And in general, your immune system is smart and recognizes when you cut yourself that that bacteria shouldn't be there and harnesses these cells sent to the area to clean things up and to heal your body. And cancer is smart and it has tricked your body into not recognizing that that doesn't belong there. And these therapies work by helping to sort of uncloak the cancer and rev up your immune system so that your immune system can recognize that the cancer doesn't belong there and attack the cancer. And unfortunately, sometimes we kind of overstimulate the immune system and we get side effects by causing inflammation to some of your good cells. And really that can happen in any organ system and at any time after the initiation of therapy. So some commonly inflammation of the thyroid, inflammation of the lungs causing pneumonitis, and you review the potential symptoms of that. Inflammation of the liver, inflammation of the kidneys, inflammation of the skin, which can just cause pruritus or rash. And I think it's really important when you're seeing a patient weekly during, or almost daily, really, you know, a patient can come over and see you when they're getting their radiation in another building if something is going on. But now once they're on immunotherapy and it's Q2 weeks, they're flying a little bit solo at home. And it's just trying to encourage them to call if anything feels different or feels strange. So empowering them to recognize what is different and to call you. Because absolutely anything can happen at any time once you've started immunotherapy.
Yeah, there's the expression, if it ends in itis, you can see it. And, you know, you'll take a look at this graphic or just some of the areas that can be affected. But Heather, I wonder if you could go a little bit more into the issue of pneumonitis, particularly trying to differentiate the pneumonitis that you get from radiation therapy from the pneumonitis that is much less common but can be seen with immunotherapy. Can you talk about that?
Absolutely. And that's a tough one. So in the old days, before we had durvalumab, we would see radiation pneumonitis, and we would warn patients that it could happen anytime from 2 weeks to 3 months after they completed their radiation, with some tails on either end of that. And that if they started to get more short of breath, especially if they noticed it when they were climbing up a flight of stairs, we didn't want them to wait and see if it got worse, but to immediately call us, because we know that if they get steroids quickly, you can change the course that could otherwise be quite catastrophic. As far as trying to distinguish that from what you get with durvalumab, it's very difficult. So you can talk about the patterns that if it's radiation pneumonitis, theoretically, it should be a bit more obvious in the fields where they've had radiation, but that's not really a great rule because radiation pneumonitis can spread from just the radiation field. If it's durvalumab induced, it should be more diffuse, but it could still be focused more on where they had radiation and where there's more lung injury. So there's not really an easy way to tell, nor do I think it's that important. I think the key thing is making sure that the patients know that if they're having more breathing trouble, they need to alert the medical team quickly so we can do further evaluation and figure out with imaging, with pulmonary function test if it is pneumonitis, and then start them on steroids very, very quickly if that's the case. That time of when you start steroids can make a big, big impact. Then, depending on the time course of how it resolves, that's the harder question. Do you ever think about a re-challenge of durvalumab? And I tend to be a bit more cautious. I've had some patients who did very poorly. At the same time, we're talking about their durvalumab having the risk of the cancer returning, improving overall survival by, you know, at least 30%. So you definitely have a pull towards restarting, and you have to balance that against what's the risk of the pneumonitis coming back, which can be fatal. So it's a very much an individual decision. And I think when you're first making the diagnosis, it's just about make the diagnosis, start the steroids. Then as that improvement happens, you can kind of weigh, well, what's the probability of causing this to flare if I restart it or not, and then to decide if you're going to move forward.
So Heather, quick follow-up question. What dose of steroids do you use? And I'll add another question. Mm-hmm. Any concerns that the corticosteroids themselves could, you know, diminish the therapeutic impact of the immunotherapy? So first of all, what dose?
So a milligram per kilogram of prednisone is sort of the standard starting dose. There are a lot of institutional standards around that, but that's sort of, it's a whopping dose to start with, and you don't want to taper too quickly if they've really developed pneumonitis. I mean, I think about a short taper as being 4 weeks in this setting. A lot of times it's even longer than that. As far as reducing the efficacy, that's a great question. There is absolutely data that if patients have been on higher doses of steroids or on antibiotics before you start them on a checkpoint inhibitor, you do potentially reduce the efficacy. These are all retrospective, so you have to be a little careful in how you interpret it, but there's a consistent story there. However, if you've already started the immune therapy, and then you have to start steroids because of an immune-related adverse event, it doesn't seem to have that much of an impact. And there's even some literature showing that if a patient develops an immune-related adverse event, preferably a lesser one, they actually have better cancer outcomes because you're showing that you've elicited this response, and theoretically you're developing a response against normal tissue, but that might also correlate with a better response against the cancer. So the fear of reducing the effectiveness of the immune therapy is never a reason not to treat the severe toxicity with steroids.
So in a second, we're going to go through a number of potential complications that can occur that the faculty submitted for a discussion, and we'll go through some of these now. But speaking of non-critical problems, we can go back. Liz, can you comment a little bit? We're going to hold off on this one, on the issue of rash. What you do about it, and also kind of endocrine problems, particularly thyroid problems, Liz, that you encounter, and how you screen for that.
Well, for the rash, we've seen erythematous dry plaques around the body. I'll initially prescribe a topical steroid, and that seems to help. If that doesn't work, We'll refer to dermatology to see if they need a stronger steroid cream or an oral steroid. The rash does occur, but it's not one of the frequent toxicities I've encountered. As for the thyroid, that's fairly frequent. And since many of our patients are now on immunotherapy, it's just part of our baseline labs to get a set of thyroid function studies at baseline. And with durvalumab, we follow the thyroid functions every other treatment. So if the treatment is every 2 weeks, we're following the thyroid functions monthly, basically. And between the results of the thyroid function studies and the patient, if they're having worsening fatigue, if indicated, we'll start Synthroid. And again, if necessary, we'll refer to endocrine. But we usually manage the thyroiditis on our own initially. The physician I work with will on occasion add ACTH and cortisol levels, and that is just something he does. So we are following those as well.
So let's get into some of these clinical scenarios. And Dr. Gubins, who's going to be on our second conference, brought up this thing really related to chemo radiation, but I thought it was really interesting. And also the fact that everybody kind of said the same thing. So the scenario he talked about, patients getting concurrent chemo radiation therapy for locally advanced disease, is scheduled to receive the treatment tomorrow. But the neutrophil count's low at 650, patient's fine, no fever, et cetera. What would you do? And it looks like everybody says skip the chemo, but do radiation therapy. What's the thinking behind that? How do you generally handle a situation where a patient's getting chemo radiation and they're neutropenic?
So one thing you need to be careful about is growth factor support can actually be harmful in this setting. Patients end up with pretty severe thrombocytopenia because it's sort of the marrow is kind of telling you it's getting a little rough here. So if you push the white counts up, you often see the platelets plummet. So there's some literature to suggest not to do that. So I will often skip the chemotherapy. If it's a weekly dosing, we just skip it entirely. If it's one of the every 3 or 4 week regimens, postponing a week means you still get that overlap of the two cycles with the concurrent radiation and the chemotherapy. So it's usually not such a big deal. I don't usually skip the radiation unless the patient has gotten quite ill or if the neutrophil count has really plummeted. And it seems like at 650, all of the panelists had that same idea. We'll hold the chemo, allow the counts to recover a little bit more, but we don't want to skip the radiation because, again, there's good data that radiation intensity is really important. And if you take big breaks in it, you can reduce some of the efficacy.
Interesting. So David actually proposed a question. I'm going to actually ask Liz. Dave wants to know, do you routinely recommend enteral feeding tubes? This was done in the past. Now we have much better radiation therapy and supportive care. How often are you using feeding tubes, Liz?
Honestly, not that often. And we don't do it prior to concurrent chemotherapy and radiation therapy. As I said earlier, we've had very, very few patients with such significant esophagitis that warranted a feeding tube that it is truly few and far between. I think it's part of the counseling from nutrition, but it's rarely, or at least with the patients we're seeing, it's rarely something we've had to resort to.
So, David, another issue that comes up is a patient who's, you know, we mentioned it's very common to see esophagitis. Is that enough to hold off starting the durvalumab? And what kind of shape do you want to see the patient in? If they're recovering from some chemo radiation, will you wait a little bit longer? How do you make that decision?
Yeah, you know, rarely has esophagitis been a reason to hold immunotherapy. I think it could be. You're really looking to see, is your patient going to be able to tolerate this toxicity getting worse? And because that, you know, that's what you're trying to prevent. You know, it could be a rash, it could be colitis, it could be pneumonitis, but further immunotherapy could make that worse, and you may not be able to rescue it with high dose steroids. So that really is how I think about deciding whether to resume therapy or not.
So another question a bunch of people asked is, and you know, we can see data from trials, but also clinical experience, Kelly, and that is, what happens during this year to Valumab? Obviously, if some of these patients might relapse, but sort of beyond that in terms of toxicity, do most patients get through a year or most of them stop? And if so, why?
I can't remember what the study showed, but I would say in our institution, probably more than 50%, less than 70% or so of patients are able to complete the full year of therapy. I think the schedule is tough for some people. I think the cumulative fatigue is tough for some people. Sometimes itching, sometimes pneumonitis, sometimes colitis, so an autoimmune toxicity. But I have actually probably only had 24 or so patients that I've personally followed who have made it through an entire year.
So, David, here's a clinical scenario from Dr. Gubins. I'm curious how you think you might approach this, and we can check out how other people think it through. So a patient with locally advanced disease getting consolidation durvalumab, doing well. And the patient's wife calls to say that over the past week he developed a dry cough that's starting to get worse, but no fever. And, of course, we haven't talked about the other big consideration nowadays in any kind of pulmonary issue, which is COVID. So maybe you can bring that in. But in any event, increasing shortness of breath, having trouble walking short distances, what do you recommend? So, Dave, can you talk about this clinical scenario and how you manage it?
Yeah, I mean, everything's on the list, right? You have traditional problems like pneumonitis, you have lung cancer, you have effusions, you have pneumonia, you have blood clots, and now we have COVID. So you need some way to assess all that. Of course, you have to decide if the patient is stable enough and should go right to the emergency room, which is difficult in this question. But I think we're all saying the same thing. Evaluate the patient clinically with radiographs and make a decision if are they safe enough for outpatient or inpatient care.
So question from the chat room, Dave, does the pneumonitis related to durvalumab, do you see it actually on the imaging? And I'll add something on top of that, which is, do you see situations where you're not sure whether it looks like COVID or not? And how often do you have to test people?
Yeah, it's really, so I have a lot of people who come in, feel great, but their scan looks terrible. And, you know, I get the results, I walk in the room and I'm like, how does this fit? In terms of the COVID, I have one patient who's been on immunotherapy for a long time. And in April, he came in right as COVID was taking off. And the radiologist called me and said, David, your patient has COVID. I said, why? He said, the CT is classic. I looked at my patient. He looked fine. We tested him. He was negative. I don't think we know everything about what a COVID scan is supposed to look like versus somebody going through, immunotherapy. So in the end, this patient had pneumonitis from his immunotherapy, not from COVID. But it can be difficult to sort out.
Are you testing your patients, David, when you start therapy? What are some of the reasons that you would test an asymptomatic patient for COVID, if any?
Well, so no, we need to make that clear. We do not test at our clinic. They get sent to places that do that testing. In fact, like everywhere, we screen them before they even come in to make sure that they're not putting others at risk. In this situation, it was unusual, right? I think in this whole COVID period, I've had 2 phone calls from radiologists that said, David, your patient has COVID. And of course, it sets off a chain of concern. We're a little bit better in terms of how we handle that now. But I think in the beginning, everybody was pretty alarmed.
So I want to show a couple of cases that Heather actually submitted. This first one is really interesting, Heather. You wrote the case down, and you're the only one who gave the answer that you gave. Everybody else gave a different answer, so I'm going to let you talk about it. So this is a 68 – I don't know if this is based on a real case or not. 68-year-old man develops dyspnea 2 months after completing chemoradiation while receiving consolidation durvalumab, and it's thought that the patient has pneumonitis. It's thought to be radiation-related, and you can talk about why you would be thinking that. So the durvalumab is held. Started on corticosteroids after a month. The patient's doing well. He's getting tapered down. Would you restart the durvalumab? That's your case, Heather. Everybody says yes, and you say no. Can you discuss it?
Yeah, I think this is what I was getting to earlier. You know, pneumonitis can be scary. Pneumonitis can be fatal. But it's not always an absolute that you would never re-challenge the patient. And of course, this is a theoretical scenario, so we can all come up with a different image in our head. I was clearly on the side of this patient was really, really sick. It's a miracle that they've gotten better. We've gotten them down to 5, but they're not off. And when we try to go below 5, they're symptomatic, so I wouldn't restart them. And everybody else is thinking, showed up on the scan, patient was okay, got the steroids, the scan's okay, so we'll try it, right? So you have to have all of those clinical scenarios in mind, and it has to be a very careful conversation with the patient and their family about that risk and benefit and where they want to tip on it. And it might be different too. I mean, this is pretty early in the course. If you're already at month 10, you're going to be less excited to give those last couple months. How much does that matter? So this is a really hard one on this sort of a guess what I was thinking question. So,
right. Yeah. And it's just really trying to get into the art of oncology, how to manage these things. We got tons of other situations that we're going to talk about in the second conference on the 5th and really get into a lot more granularity. But I want to do one more clinical scenario because, again, I think it's interesting. One person, Kelly, had a different approach. So 60-year-old woman, locally advanced disease, getting chemotherapy and radiation therapy, now is on consolidation durvalumab, but after 5 days calls in complaining of diarrhea, 4 loose bowel movements in the past 24 hours. And Heather wondered, no, do you advise her to take the loperamide? Everybody says yes. What were you thinking, Kelly?
We like to err on the side of caution and kind of reinforce the teaching points and what to look for and what to call us for. We don't recommend loperamide right up front when they start developing diarrhea. We like to have a conversation with them about, you know, have they changed their diet now that they are recovering from chemotherapy and radiation. Maybe they had been on stool softeners or laxatives because they were on antiemetics with their cisplatin or because, you know, for another chemotherapy that they were having with their concurrent radiation, and did they remember to stop those? And then I think that, you know, some patients we just need to see, are you also having associated symptoms that, you know, would be infectious and I need to have you come in and check stool studies? Or are you having, you know, are you having a hard time in your hydration status and we need to see you for supportive care since you're so close to completing your chemotherapy and radiation? So I think we tend to err on the side of caution, and we typically want to see them and just reevaluate them, make sure that that they're robust enough before we start saying, go ahead and take your loperamide. We also maybe just fall into kind of a more extensive conversation or workup because we have such great resources at Mass General who help us with immune-mediated toxicities. And so we have kind of a low threshold to check in with those folks to see if they want additional labs or studies.
So we had another case. We'll squeeze in one more for you, David. Again, this is another Heather's case. A 75-year-old lady gets chemo radiation therapy, now is on consolidation durvalumab, and all of a sudden her blood glucose starts going up. And the question is, do you think this could be related to the immunotherapy? Because she has secondary diabetes. David, have you seen that?
Yeah, I've seen it with Nevo-Ipi, not with Durva. I've seen it twice with Nevo-Ipi. So here's the thing about that. It's kind of like thyroid problems. In this case, if it's truly diabetes related to immunotherapy, you've depleted the islet cells. And so ongoing immunotherapy is not going to make that worse. So I don't see an issue here, but you got to be aware if the patient has new diabetes.
Yeah, and just picking it up and managing it is an important issue. So I want to thank our faculty today. It was awesome to work with you. Thank you all for attending.